You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in London, England, which are the sole providers of English translations of Rudolf Steiner and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures in four parts by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Harmony of the Creative Word, the Human Being and the Elemental, Animal, Plant, and Mineral Kingdoms. This is the last lecture of the 12, of the fourth part. Which is called The Secrets of the Human Organism. This is lecture 12, given on the 11th of November, 1923. Once we realize that external nature is transformed inside the human organism, and this in so radical a way that the mineral, for example, must be lifted into the warmth ether, we will also know that all that lives in man, in the human organization, is connected with the spiritual. If we follow the ideas that commonly arise in connection with the illustrations seen in conventional textbooks of anatomy and physiology, and imagine man to be a solid body that takes into itself the products of external nature, and that these remain almost unchanged in the human body, then we will always suffer from the lack of a necessary bridge spanning between what exists in man as part of the physical world and the world with which he is connected through his essential soul nature. At first we shall be unable to find any connection between the skeletal and muscular systems, which we imagine to be solid physical substance, and for instance the moral world, order. It will be said that the one is simply physical nature and the other, and that the other is something radically different from physical nature. But when we are clear about the fact that all forms of substantiality are present in man, and that everything must go through a stage where it is more volatile than muscles and bones are, we shall come to realize that this more volatile and etheric substance can enter into connection with the impulses of the moral world order. This is the point of departure for our present considerations, and for then tracing the connection between man and the higher realms of the spiritual and the cosmos, the beings whom we have called the beings of the higher hierarchies. In the earlier lectures, we took our starting point more from the world of nature. Today, however, let us take our start from the spiritual and moral impulses that are active in the human realm. In modern civilization, terms such as spiritual and moral have more or less become routine, conventional ideas. The pure original feeling for the moral and spiritual element in human nature has increasingly been lost. The whole approach to education in modern civilization leads man to ask, what is customary? What has convention ordained? What is the code? What is the law? And so on. Less account is taken of what comes forth as impulses and is rooted in the part of man which is often relegated in a vague way to conscience. This inner directing of oneself, this determining of one's own goals, is something that has increasingly been lost in modern civilization. Hence the spiritual and moral has finally become little more than convention and tradition. Earlier world conceptions, particularly those which were sustained by instinctive clairvoyance, brought forth moral impulses from man's inner nature. Moral impulses still exist, but today they have become tradition. And we need to realize the extent to which this is true. Of course, nothing whatever is implied here against traditional morality, but only think of the Ten Commandments and how old they are. They are taught as commands recorded in ancient times. Is it to be expected today that something might spring forth from the primary elemental sources of human nature, which could be compared to what once arose as the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments? From what source does the moral and spiritual arise, which binds people together in a social way, which knits the threads uniting person to person? There is only one true source of the moral and spiritual in mankind, and this is what we may call mutual understanding and a love for humanity that is based on this human understanding. Wheresoever we may look for the source of moral and spiritual impulses in mankind, in so far as these play a role in social life, it will invariably turn out that such impulses have sprung forth in their pure form from human understanding and human love. These are the actual driving force for moral and spiritual impulses in the social sphere. And fundamentally speaking, in so far as he is a spiritual being, man lives from one thing only when he is with other human beings, from developing human love and understanding. Here you may ask a significant question, a question that is indeed not always voiced, but should indeed be on the tip of every tongue, particularly in regard to what has just been said. If human love and understanding are the real impulses on which communal life depends, how does it come about that exactly the reverse, lack of understanding and hatred of our fellow human beings, appear in our social order? This is a question with which initiates, more than anyone else, have always concerned themselves. In every age in which initiation science arose as an impulse, this very question was regarded as one of their most vital concerns. When this initiation science was still a primal impulse, however, it possessed certain means of finding the solution to the problem. But if one looks at conventional science today, one is forced to ask, as the God-created soul is naturally predisposed to human understanding and human love, why are these qualities not active as a matter of course in the social order? Whence come human hatred and lack of human understanding? Now, if we are unable to look for them in the realm of soul and spirit, it follows that we must look for them in the physical realm. Yes, but in modern conventional science, the answer as to what the physical bodily nature of man is tends to be blood, nerves, muscles, bones. No matter how long one studies a bone, if one only does so with the eye of present science, one will never be able to say that bone is what leads man astray into hatred. And to whatever degree one is able to investigate the blood according to the principles by which it is investigated today, one will never be able to say, this blood is what leads man astray into lack of human understanding. In times when initiation science was a primal impulse, matters were certainly quite different. Then one turned one's gaze to the physical bodily nature of man and perceived it to be the counter-image of what instinctive clairvoyance provided at the level of mind and spirit. When people think of the things of the spirit today, they refer at most to abstract thoughts. These are what they regard as spiritual. If they find these thoughts too tenuous, all that remains to them is words, and then they do as Fritz Mautner has done in his title Critique of Language. He manages to dilute the spirit, already tenuous enough, until it becomes utterly devoid of substance, and nothing but abstract ideas. The people who had initiation knowledge, irradiated with instinctive clairvoyance, did not see the things of the spirit in terms of abstract thought. They saw the things of the spirit as forms and figures, as something that took the form of images, something that was able to speak and resound, The spiritual was alive for those who had that initiation knowledge. And because the spiritual was seen in a living way, the physical, blood and bones, could also be perceived in its spirituality. This initiation knowledge did not include the thoughts and notions that we have today about the skeleton. Today the skeleton is really regarded as something constructed by the calculations of an architect for the purposes of physiology and anatomy, but it is not. The skeleton, as you have seen, is given form by taking mineral substance upward to the state of warmth ether, so that in the warmth ether, the forces of the higher hierarchies are able to intervene, and out of this the bones are created. To one who is able to behold it rightly, the skeleton reveals its spiritual origin. But one who looks at the skeleton in its present form, I mean in the way in which present-day scientists tend to regard it, is like a person standing before a printed page with shapes on it that are letters, but who does not read their meaning because he is unable to read. He does not relate what is expressed in the shape of the letters to what lies behind them. He only describes their shapes. In the same way, present-day anatomists and scientists describe the bones as if they were entirely without meaning. What they really reveal, however, is their origin in the spiritual. And so it is with everything that exists as physical and etheric natural laws. They are written characters from the spiritual world. And we only understand these things rightly when we can comprehend them as written characters proceeding from spiritual worlds. Now, when we are able to regard the human organism in this way, we become aware of something which belongs to the domain of which the true initiates of all epochs have said, in crossing the threshold into the spiritual world, the first thing one becomes aware of is something terrible, something which at first is by no means easy to bear. Most people wish to take pleasure in what seems to them worthy of attainment. But the fact remains that only by passing through the experience of shock can one learn to know spiritual reality, that is to say, true reality. For in regard to the anatomical and physiological human form, one will perceive that the spiritual world has built it up out of two elements, moral coldness and hatred. In our souls, we truly possess the predisposition to human love and that moral warmth which understands the other human being. In the solid components of our organism, however, we bear moral coldness. This is the force through which the spiritual world welds, as it were, our physical organism together. We bear in ourselves the impulse of hatred. This derives from the spiritual world to bring about our blood circulation. And whereas we may perhaps go through the world with a very loving soul, with a soul that thirsts for human understanding, we must nevertheless be aware that below, in the subconscious, where the soul streams into the physical body and sends its impulses into it, for the very person that we may be clothed in a body, coldness has its seat. Though I will just use the word coldness all the time, what I mean is moral coldness, though this can certainly pass over into physical coldness by way of the warmth ether. There, below, in the subconscious, moral coldness and hatred have their seat. And it is easy for man to bring into his soul what is present in his body, so that his soul can, as it were, be infected with lack of human understanding. This is, however, the result of moral coldness and human hatred. Because this is so, man must gradually cultivate in himself moral warmth, that is to say, human understanding and love, for these must vanquish what comes from bodily nature. Now it cannot be denied, this presents itself in all clarity to spiritual vision, that in our age, which began with the 15th century and has developed in an intellectualistic way, on the one hand, and in a materialistic way, on the other, much lack of understanding and human hatred has become embedded in human souls. This is so to a greater degree than is supposed. For only when man passes through the gate of death does he become aware of how much lack of understanding, how much hatred is present in the unconscious. There man detaches his soul and spiritual from his physical bodily nature. He lays his physical bodily nature aside. The impulses of coldness, the impulses of hatred, then reveal themselves simply as natural forces, as mere forces of nature. Let us look at a corpse. Let us even look with spiritual gaze upon the etheric corpse. Here we are looking at something which no longer evokes moral judgment any more than does a plant or a stone. The moral forces which have previously been contained in what is now the corpse have been changed into natural forces. During his lifetime, however, the human being absorbed a great deal from them. This he takes with him through the gate of death. The ego and astral body withdraw, taking with them as they go what remained unnoticed during life, because it was always entirely submerged in the physical and etheric bodies. The ego and astral body take with them into the spiritual world all the impulses of human hatred and coldness toward others that have gained access to their souls. As I said, it is only when one sees the human being pass through the gate of death that one perceives how much failure to understand, how much human hatred have been implanted into the individual, particularly in our civilization, by various things about which I shall still have to speak. Human beings of today carry a great deal of these two impulses through the gate of death, a very great deal indeed. But what man thus carries with him is in fact the spiritual residue of what should exist in the physical, of what should constitute the physical and etheric bodies. In the lack of human understanding and the human hatred which man takes into the spiritual world, we have the residue of what really belongs in the physical world. He carries it there in a spiritual way, but to carry it onward through the time between death and a new birth would make him quite unable to progress. At every step in his further evolution, between death and a new birth, he would stumble if he were obliged to carry further this failure to understand the other individual, this human hatred. In the spiritual world, which is entered by the so-called dead, one continually sees currents that would prevent further development if they continued to act exactly as they are. Where do these currents originate? To discover this, we need only look at modern life. People pass one another by. They pay little heed to the individual nature of others. Are not people today mostly so constituted that each one regards himself as the standard of what is right and proper? And when someone differs from this standard, we do not take kindly to him, but rather think that this person should be different. And this usually applies. He should be like me. We are not always aware of this, but it is to be found specifically in human social intercourse. In the way things manifest today, for instance, in the whole manner and form of people's speech, there lies very little understanding of the other person. People bellow out their ideas about how human beings should behave, but this usually means everyone should be like me. If someone comes along who is completely different, he is immediately regarded as an enemy, an object for antipathy, though we tend not to be fully conscious of this. There is lack of human understanding, of moral warmth, and of love. And to the degree in which these qualities are lacking, moral coldness and human hatred go with man through the gate of death, obstructing his path. Having gone through the gate of death, however, he finds that his further development is not his own concern alone, but the concern of the whole world order, the wisdom-filled world order. First of all, he finds in the other world beings of the third hierarchy, angels, archangels, archai. In the first period, after man has passed through the gate of death into the world lying between death and a new birth, these beings stoop downward and mercifully take from man the coldness which comes from lack of human understanding. And we see how the beings of the third hierarchy assume the burden of what man carries up to them into the spiritual world, in the way I have described, by passing through the gate of death. It is for a longer period that man must carry with him the remains of human hatred, for this can only be taken from him by grace of the spirits of the second hierarchy, exousiae, curiotites, dunamis. They take from him all that remains of human hatred. And then the human being arrives in the region between death and a new birth, where the first hierarchy, seraphim, cherubim, thrones, have their abiding place, which I described in my mystery play as the midnight hour of existence in the spirit. Man would be quite unable to pass through this region of the seraphim, cherubim, and thrones without being inwardly annihilated, utterly destroyed, had not the beings of the second and third hierarchies already taken from him, in their mercy, human lack of understanding, that is to say, moral coldness and human hatred. And so, we see how man, in order to find access to the impulses that can contribute to his further development, must at first burden the beings of the higher hierarchies with what he carries up into the spiritual world from his physical and etheric bodies, where it really belongs. When one has insight into all this, when one sees how this moral coldness exists in the spiritual world, one will also know how to judge the relation between this spiritual coldness and the physical coldness that exists here below. The physical coldness which we find in snow and ice is only the physical image of the moral and spiritual coldness which is there above. If we have them both before us, we can compare them. While man is being relieved in this way of human misunderstanding and human hatred, one can follow with the spiritual eye, EYE, how he begins to lose his form, how this form more or less melts away. When someone first passes through the gate of death, to the spiritual vision of imagination, his appearance is still somewhat similar to what it was here on earth. For what a human being bears within him here on earth is in fact just substances in more or less granular form, let us say in atomistic form, but the human figure itself, that is spiritual. We must really be clear about this. It is sheer nonsense to regard the human form as physical. We must see it as a spiritual form. The physical in it is everywhere present as minute particles. The form, which is only a force body, holds together what would otherwise fall apart into a heap of atoms. If someone were to take any of you by the forelock and extract your form, the physical and also the etheric would collapse like a heap of sand. That these are not just a sand heap, that they are distributed and take on form, stems from nothing physical. It stems from the spiritual. Here in the physical world, man goes about as something spiritual. It is senseless to think that man is only a physical being. His form is purely spiritual. The physical in him may almost be likened to a heap of crumbs. Man, however, still possesses his form when he goes through the gate of death. One sees it shimmering, glittering, radiant with colors. But now he loses first the form of his head, then the rest of his form gradually melts away. Man becomes completely metamorphosed, as though transformed into an image of the cosmos. This occurs during the time between death and a new birth, when he comes into the region of the seraphim, cherubim, and thrones. Thus, when one follows the human being between death and a new birth, one at first still sees him, as it were, continue to be active, while he gradually loses his form from above downward. But as the last vestige of him is vanishing away below, something else has evolved, a wonderful spirit form, which is in itself an image of the whole world sphere, and at the same time a model of the future head which the human being will bear on his shoulders. Here the human being is involved in an activity wherein not only the beings of the lower hierarchies participate, but also the beings of the highest hierarchy, the seraphim, cherubim, and thrones. What actually takes place? It is the most wonderful thing of which we human beings can possibly conceive. For all that was lower man here in life now passes over into the formation of the future head. As we go about here on earth, we only have our poor head as the organ of our mental images and our thoughts. But thoughts also accompany our chest, thoughts also particularly accompany our limbs. And the moment we cease to think only with the head, but begin to think with our limbs, in that moment the whole reality of karma is opened up to us. We know nothing of our karma, because we always think only with that most superficial of organs, our brain. The moment we begin to think with our fingers, and just with our fingers and toes, we can think much more brightly than with the nerves of the head. Once we have soared up to the possibility of doing so, the moment we begin to think with what has not become entirely material. When we begin to think with the lower man, our thoughts are the thoughts of our karma. When we do not merely grasp with our hand, but think with it, then, thinking with our hand, we follow our karma. And even more so with the feet. When we do not only walk, but think with our feet, we follow the course of our karma with special clarity. That man is such a dullard on earth, excuse me, but no other word occurs to me, comes from the fact that all his thinking is enclosed in the region of his head. But man can think with his entire being. Whenever we think with our entire being, then for our middle region, a whole cosmology, a marvelous cosmic wisdom, becomes our own. And for the lower region and the limb system especially, karma becomes our own. We already do a good deal just by looking at the way a person walks, not in a dull way, but marking the beauty of his step and what is characteristic in it. Or, when we allow his hands to make an impression upon us, so that we interpret these hands and think that in every moment of the fingers there lie wonderful revelations of man's inner nature. Yet, that is only the least part of what moves as man walks, or takes hold of something with his hand, or just moves his fingers. For it is man's whole moral nature which moves. His destiny moves with him, everything that he is as a spiritual being. And if, after man has passed through the gate of death, we are able to follow how his form dissolves, anything reminiscent of the physical form is first to melt away. There then appears what does indeed resemble his physical structure, but which, in its inner nature, its inner being, makes us aware that this is the moral form. This is what happens to man as he approaches the midnight hour of existence and comes into the sphere of the seraphim, cherubim, and thrones. We see how this wonderful metamorphosis occurs, how his form melts away. but this is not really the essential point. It looks as though the form would dissolve away, but the truth is that the spiritual beings of the higher worlds are there, working together with man. They work with the human beings who are working on themselves and on others with whom they have karmic connections. One human being works on the other. These spiritual beings, then, together with man himself, develop the form he had in his previous earthly life into what will be his form in his next earthly life. Initially, this is a spiritual form. The spirit form will finally connect with the embryo in physical life. But in the spiritual world, feet and legs are transformed into the jawbones, while arms and hands are transformed into cheekbones. The whole lower man is transformed into the spiritual beginnings of what will later be the head. The way in which this metamorphosis is accomplished is, I do assure you, the most wonderful of everything that the world offers to conscious experience. We see at first how an image of the whole cosmos is created, and how this is then condensed and differentiated into the form which the whole moral element attaches to, but only after all that I have mentioned has been taken from it. We see how what was transforms itself into what will be. Now one sees the human being as spirit form, journeying back once more to the region of the second hierarchy, and then to that of the third hierarchy. Here the metamorphosed spirit form, it is in fact only the basis for the future head, must, as it were, have added to it what will become the future chest organs, the future limbs and metabolic organs. These must be added. Whence come the spiritual impulses to add them? It is by grace of the beings of the second and third hierarchies, who gathered these impulses together when the human being was on the first half of his journey. They took from his moral nature. Now they bring them back again and shape them into the basis for the rhythmical system and the system of metabolism and limbs. In this later period between death and a new birth, man receives the ingredients, the spiritual ingredients, for his physical organism. This spiritual form finds its way into the embryo and brings to it what now turns into physical and etheric forces. These are, however, only the physical image of what we bear in us from our previous life as lack of human understanding and as human hatred, and from which our limb organization is spiritually formed. If we wish to see things in this way, we must acquire a manner of feeling and perceiving quite other than that needed in the physical world. For we must be able to look at the things of the spirit that become physical in man in the way I have described. We must be able to bear the knowledge that coldness, moral coldness, lives as physical image in the bones, and that moral hatred lives as physical image in the blood. We must learn to look at these matters quite objectively. It is, in fact, only when we look into things in this way that we become aware of the fundamental difference between man's inner being and the world of nature outside. Just consider for a moment the fact I mentioned, namely, that in the flowers of the plant kingdom we see, as it were, human conscience laid out before us. What we see outside us may be considered as the picture of our inner life. The forces within ourselves may appear to have no relation to outer nature, but the truth is, bone can only be bone because it hates calcium carbonate and calcium phosphate in their mineral state, because it withdraws from them, contracting into itself, whereby it becomes something different from what these substances are in external nature. And one must be able to accept that for man to have a physical form, hatred and coldness must be present in his physical nature. Through this, you see, our words gain inner significance. It is good for our bones to have a certain hardness. They have it as a physical image of spiritual coldness. But it is not good for our social life if our souls have this hardness. The physical nature of man must be different from his soul nature. Man is able to be man precisely because his physical being differs from his soul and spirit. Man's physical nature also differs from physical nature around him. On this rests the necessity for transformation about which I have spoken to you. All this forms an important supplement to what I once said in the course on Cosmology, Philosophy, and Religion about man's connection with the hierarchies. Footnote, 10 lectures given at the Goetheanum in September 1922, at the Basopic Press, New York, 1984. Readers aside, those are also on this website. End of readers aside. It could only be added, however, on such initial considerations as those in our present lectures. For spiritual vision gives insight alike into what the separate members of the mineral, animal, and plant kingdoms really are here on earth, and into the work of the hierarchies, work that continues from age to age, as do also the processes that occur in the physical world and the works of man. When man's life, between death and a new birth, his life in the spiritual world, is beheld in this way, one can describe his experiences in that world in just as much detail as his biography here on earth. So we may live in the hope that when we pass through the gate of death, all that we take into the world of the spirit as lack of understanding and human hatred may be given back to us again and ennobled through human forms being created from it. In the course of long centuries, something very strange has come to pass, however, for the present stage of human evolution. It no longer proved possible to use up all the forces of human lack of understanding and human hatred and make them into new human forms in the world of the spirit. Something was left over. In the course of the last centuries, this residue has streamed down onto the earth, so that in the spiritual atmosphere of the earth, and what I may call the earth's astral light, there is to be found an infiltration of the impulses of human hatred and human contempt, impulses that exist exterior to man. These have not been incorporated into human forms. They stream around the earth in the astral light. They influence man, not individual human beings, but the relationships which people form with one another on the earth. They influence civilization. And within civilization, they have brought about what compelled me to say in the spring of 1914 in Vienna, that our present-day civilization is invaded by a spiritual cancer, by spiritual ulcers. Footnote, he's referring to a set of lectures entitled The Inner Nature of Man and Our Life Between Death and Rebirth, eight lectures given in Vienna in April 1914, Rudolf Steiner Press. Readers aside, those are also on this website, and a readers aside and a footnote. At the time, I spoke of this in the lecture course dealing with the phenomena occurring between death and a new birth. People did not like hearing it. Since then, however, some of the truth of what was said has been recognized. At the time, people had no awareness of what streams through civilization. They did not perceive that actual cancerous formations were present in civilization, for it was only from 1914 onward that these erupted. Today, they are revealed as utterly diseased tissues of civilization. It is possible to see everything that lives in a civilization as an integral spiritual entity. And we find that in this modern civilization of ours, which has been infiltrated by the currents of human hatred and human coldness not used up in human forms, those currents have become the parasitic element of modern civilization. Civilization has profoundly parasitic tendencies today. It is like a part of an organism that is invaded by parasites, by bacilli. What people have amassed in the way of thoughts exists, but it has no living connection with man. Only consider how this shows itself in the most ordinary phenomena of daily life. People have to learn because things are there to be learned. They do not bring enthusiasm to their learning, but simply have to get down to it and learn in order to pass an examination, so as to qualify for some particular post or the like. Well, for them there is no vital connection between what they have to take in and what lives in their soul as an inborn desire for the things of the mind and spirit. It is exactly as though a person who is not predisposed to hunger were to be continually stuffing himself with food. The food does not go through the transformations about which I have spoken. It turns into ballast in the organism, finally becoming something which literally invites parasites. Much in our modern civilization has no connection with man. Like the mistletoe, spiritually speaking, it lives on what man brings forth from the original impulses of his mind and heart. Much of this manifests in our civilization as parasitic existence. To anyone who has the power of seeing our civilization with spiritual vision, in the astral light, as it were, the year 1914 already presented an advanced stage of cancer, a tumor. For him, the whole of civilization was already invaded by parasites. But then something further is added to this parasitic condition. I have described to you in what may be called a spiritual physiology how the nature of the gnomes and undines, who work from below upward, give rise to the possibility of parasitic impulses in man. Then, however, as I explained, the opposite picture presents itself in contrast, for poison is carried downward by the sylphs and the elemental beings of warmth. And so, in a civilization like ours, which bears a parasitic character, what comes down from above, spiritual truth, though not poison in itself, is transformed into poison in man, so that our civilization rejects it in fear and invents all kinds of reasons for this rejection. The two things belong together. A parasitic culture below, which does not proceed from elemental laws, and therefore contains parasites within itself, and spirituality that comes down from above, and as it enters into civilization, is taken up by man in such a way that it becomes poison. When you bear this in mind, you have the key to the most important symptoms of modern civilization. And when one has insight into these things, the necessary educational aspect will, of its own accord, reveal itself as the right medicine for our civilization. Just as a rational therapy evolves from a true diagnosis, a true pathology of the individual, so a diagnosis of the sickness of a civilization reveals the remedy. The one calls forth the other. It is very evident that mankind today again needs a kind of civilization that comes really close to the human heart and the human soul, and springs directly from the human heart and the human soul. If a child, on entering primary school, is introduced to a highly sophisticated system of letter forms which he has to learn as A, B, C, etc., he does not relate to this in heart and soul. He has no relation to them at all. What the child develops in his head, in his heart and soul, by having to learn A, B, C, is, spiritually speaking, a parasite in human nature. During his years of education, a great deal is brought to the child of this parasitic nature. We must, therefore, develop an art of education that works creatively from his soul. We must let the child give form to colors, and the color forms that have arisen out of joy, out of disappointment, out of every possible feeling. These he can put on paper, pleasure and pain. When a child puts on paper what arises out of his soul, this develops his humanity. This produces nothing parasitic. This is something which grows out of man like his fingers or his nose. Whereas, when the letters of the alphabet, which are the product of advanced civilization, are imposed on the human being, this does engender a parasitic element. The moment the art of education lies close to the human heart, to the human soul, the spiritual can be brought to man without becoming poison. First you have the diagnosis, which finds that our age is infested with carcinomas. And then you have the therapy. Yes, it is Waldorf school education. Waldorf school education is founded upon nothing other than this, my dear friends. Here the thinking about the cultural sphere is the same as that applied in the field of medicine. This is the specific application of what I spoke about a few days ago, namely that the being of man progresses to the development of the spiritual from below upward, from nutrition through healing, and that one must regard education as medicine transposed into the realm of mind and spirit. This strikes us with particular clarity when we wish to find a therapy for civilization. For we can only conceive this therapy as being Waldorf school education. You will readily be able to imagine the feelings of one who not only has insight into this situation, but who is also trying to develop Waldorf school education in a practical way, when he sees the general effect of this carcinoma of civilization giving rise to conditions in Central Europe that may seriously endanger this Waldorf school education, or even make it altogether impossible. We should not reject such thoughts as these, but rather make them the impulse within ourselves to work together wherever we still can in the therapy of our civilization. During my Helsinki lecture course in 1913, footnote entitled The Occult Significance of the Bhagavad Gita, 9 lectures, end of footnote, I expressed from a certain perspective of spiritual knowledge a view about the inferior nature of Woodrow Wilson, who then became a veritable object of veneration for much of civilized mankind, and in respect of whom people are only now, because to do otherwise is impossible, gaining some measure of perception. As things went then, so have things also gone in regard to the carcinoma of civilization about which I spoke in Vienna. Well, that is how these things went. Today the same holds true for the things that apply in our time. People are asleep. It is time, however, that we woke up. And anthroposophy bears within it all the impulses for a real awakening of civilization and culture, for man's true cultural awakening. This is what I wish to say to you in the last of these lectures. And that is the end of Lecture 12 and the end of the book, Harmony of the Creative Word, the Human Being and the Elemental Animal, Plant, and Mineral Kingdoms, revised translation by Matthew Barton. It is Collected Works, Volume 230.